This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer. It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello, it's the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. However, today with me, Tom Bushell. We've been talking about quitting smoking ahead of Ramadan, COVID vaccine side effects, kilts, because it is International Tartan Day today, and during our psychology hour, we touched on FOGO, fear of going out. And we also looked at the benefits of getting active and taking up a sport to strengthen your mental health during the pandemic.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Good afternoon. Hello, it's Tom Bushell here in for Helen Farmer. We start with the ever popular topic for so many, the art of stopping smoking. With Ramadan coming up, many people see it as a good time to stop. And I'm delighted to be joined on the line today by Iyad Hassan, a certified tobacco treatment specialist. Good afternoon, Iyad. How are you?
I am doing well. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. It's great to have you on today. I've certainly had my battles with smoking over the years, and it is such a continuous hot topic, really, isn't it, for so many. So it's great to be able to get some insights from yourself today. And a little bit later on, actually, we are going to ask if you are struggling to give up smoking, to do give us a call, and we'll try and get you on the line to speak to Iyad this afternoon. I'm sure you'll be able to help a few people today. But as Ramadan comes up, Iyad, what makes Ramadan the ideal time to quit smoking, in your experience?
Not a problem. Listen, it's actually an annual question for me, right? So this is the perfect opportunity to quit. Why? For any Muslim who knows, besides abstaining from food during the day, you're also not allowed to smoke. So abstaining during daylight hours means that half the work is already done. So I always tell people that since Ramadan is not just a focus on food, it's really a focus on faith, you should try to leverage your faith as much as you can. When you get those urges, when you get those concerns of like, oh my God, I'm getting the withdrawals. The main thing, what I tell people to do is, if you're able to write it out, each time, if you can, hold off longer and longer and longer after iftar or after you're able to eat. And then over the 30 days, you'll be able to literally overcome the habit. And many people who actually follow that plan have said it was an easier transition, because what it was, again, faith helped them overcome their actual withdrawals and their concerns of literally trying to relapse or going back and relapsing from it. So each second that passes by is a great second in your life. That's what I always tell them.
Absolutely. And I have to admit, though, just to back that up as well, I mean, it is a great time because you do have that obviously those hours where you're not smoking. What I've found and when I've spoken to, you know, smokers I've known in the past is when they have to go through a period of not being able to smoke, for instance, on a flight, their mind instantly is thinking ahead to when they can have a cigarette. So how can you overcome that?
So the main thing is just, especially if you're on a flight or, listen, the best example is the individuals who sadly are admitted in a hospital. I always use this example. And the same thing with a flight. When you're on a flight or you're inside a hospital and you can't smoke, right? What happens, this is the mental side of it. What happens is your common sense takes over. Right? Yeah. Makes sense, because when your common sense takes over, it says, I don't want to break the rules. But okay, it's either smoke or break the rules. So when individuals actually use their common sense and say, I'm in a hospital, I'm in a bed, I'm here possibly due to smoking or something else, I always tell them your mind controls it and literally blocks the urges completely. That's why, sadly, though, when they get off the plane or immediately when they leave the hospital, the urges leave or the urges dominate and the block is lifted. So they run away to do it. So what is ultimately the main thing to do? Once you land, even though you have the urge to smoke, it doesn't mean you have to smoke. I always tell my patients it's because you want to smoke. But they go, Dr. Iyad, I have a question for you. I know I want to smoke, but how do I control it? It's, you've already did it. You already found the way and you already found the path, because you were able to abstain if you're flying from here to the U.S. 14 hours, or if, God forbid, you were inside a hospital for a day or so, you've been 24. It's ultimately your mentality that needs to win over the physical drive of it.
It's so much more a psychological thing to get over, isn't it, than a physical addiction?
Well, no, actually, I will tell you, it depends. When you come into our clinic that we have here at the Cleveland Clinic, when you come in, we assess which side of it. So, Tom, here's what breaks it down. There are some individuals that are more physically addicted. And sadly, those are the ones who are 2-3 packs a day, multiple midwaf puffs a day, ones who smoke shisha every day. There is a physical drive. I'll give you the classic example without it. Are you a coffee drinker?
I am.
Okay, my friend, if you don't drink coffee for a day or two, how do you feel?
Fine. feel
so you're great. One of the few that actually makes it through. But yeah. Sadly, with many of the individuals who don't drink coffee, they get the severe headaches, they get those crankiness, etc.
Yeah.
So those individuals actually do have that physical addiction. There yeah. are individuals, though, with cigarettes, going back to cigarettes or tobacco themselves, they are psychologically addicted. They actually feel that it's my best friend.
Yeah.
I can't live without it.
Yeah.
I have to have it. Sadly, for some women, they feel that they can't be able to go to the bathroom without it. So they're psychologically hooked on it. And that's a myth. And you don't need a cigarette. The cigarette needs you. That's what I always tell my patients.
Absolutely. And I fully appreciate that. And the best friend side of things as well. I feel like, I mean, I know what you mean when you say that, but I feel like, for instance, over the last year, when maybe people who are living alone, for instance, have been in their own company so much more and not socializing as much as we've gone through the last year of this pandemic and perhaps, you know, through those lockdown days of being in an apartment on your own. Do you think that would have been a time when a lot of people maybe fell back into smoking because all of a sudden they weren't distracted by the everyday busyness of life?
Oh, yeah. That is probably, sadly, with the COVID situation, I would say we probably have seen a lot of individuals actually relapse or start this new habit because, again, it's been the classic habit to fill the time.
Yeah.
And that's what many of my patients and even my friends say. It's like they always joke with me because I always try to motivate them. I always say, it fills my time. It gives me something to do. It makes me forget about the world at times. And so that's the power of tobacco, or should I say nicotine itself, that makes it so appealing. Because, you know, if you have a bad day, what do many of your colleagues probably do when it's time is they go out and have a quick smoke break. It's their escape. It's their drive. And sadly, COVID hasn't allowed us to do any type of distraction. And so many people have said, I'm bored. I'm emotionally drained. I don't know what to do.
Sure.
And the cigarette actually becomes that fill-in time or that new friend that they can't connect with.
What fascinates me as well, and I'd love to know your thoughts on this in terms of the addiction of smoking, is, I mean, human beings are designed to survive. That's why we have feelings of fear, pain, to ward us off from danger. What is it about nicotine that overrides those survival instincts and essentially, you know, as you say, mentioned before, the common sense aspect just absolutely disappears?
Yeah, so realistically, I always tell everybody that we have actually nicotinic receptors or nicotine receptors in our brain. They're naturally in there. And so what usually happens, and most people, sadly, in research demonstrates that most people start smoking in their teens. With that being said, you literally start creating more and more and more receptors as you smoke. And what happens is, and picture a receptor in the brain or an area where nicotine goes to, okay? And just a side note for all the listeners out there, it only takes nicotine 8 to 10 seconds to get into your brain. One puff only 8 to 10 seconds. So that's the first, and that's the hard part about it right there, where you go back to your question, is it's an instantaneous feeling. You feel like, wow, I got the power from this. So what happens over time, we make more of those areas. So Tom, I don't know much thing, but if you have children, or if our listeners are there and they have children, if they remember how they used to throw temper tantrums.
Yeah.
Temper tantrums, screaming and everything. So what do? We try to give them what they can to feed them, to give them something to suck on, something to delay them.
Yeah.
Sadly, the areas in the brain are just like that. So what happens is it's almost like this is screaming in their head so much, screaming in their head, feed me, feed me, feed me. Mm. It's like over time, because if they keep building smoking, it's like a million kids screaming in their head, feed me. And so that's the hard part to come about it, which is sadly the physical side of it. And then when they're not fed, or when we try to quiet them down, when, say, you've tried to quit, the mental side comes in, but what about the kids over there? They're kind of crying. You've avoided them long enough. And so you kind of give in. And so the human aspect of it says, this isn't the right thing for me. But the addiction says, but I just want to quiet the noise that's in my head. Yeah. That's why research demonstrates medication plus support is probably your better answer to helping you quit smoking.
Yeah, no, that makes absolute sense. Just talk to us then about some of the simple tips that smokers can adopt to quit smoking over the course of the next few weeks.
Sure. So this is, as a joke to all the listeners, this is Dr. Iyad's Smart Quit. So the SMART stands for S-M-A-R-T, the five steps I think that you need. Here we go. First step I always tell all my patients is find the strategy that works best for you. Strategy usually means I want to try to quit cold turkey. I want to try to quit with a friend. I want to try to come to a clinic. I want to try to do something specific. Usually research, again, and I think I said this before in our previous stretch, research really does demonstrate medication plus some type of support program actually betters your chances of quitting. The M in SMART stands for motivation. You really have to assess yourself to be motivated. For example, I always tell my patients 0 to 10. 0 means why the world am I here at all? I don't really want to quit. 10 is I'm ready to throw the pack out right now. Ultimately, what I tell them, if you're really motivated, and let's say you're a 5 out of 10, a 7 out of 10, or whatever, you have that motivation. So I would say try. But if you're not motivated, we know how it is. Everybody who tries to come up with some type of belief that I'm going to make a change today but isn't motivated to do it, it never happens. The next three are literally the A, the R, and the T, the art of it, as we'll call it. The art of it is important because this is where smokers really have to delve in. A stands for awareness. You have to become very aware of your smoking habit. Many smokers don't even realize. They'll come and tell me, I smoke a pack a day. I go, okay, let's count. And then in the end, once we count, they actually smoke almost a pack and a half to 2 packs a day, right? The R stands for the reasons. You have to come up with a reason. And the research demonstrates that if you don't make an internal, like you don't do it for yourself, the chances are you won't do it at all. I mean, people have told me, my wife wants me to quit. My daughter wants me to quit. And so I always tell them, great. Or my doctor wants me to quit. Well, what about you? Do you want to quit? No. Well, you got to have that reason for you. And T of the whole thing is actually give it time. Time and a total commitment is what you're wanting to build for. Time, because most smokers need 6 to 9 quits before they get it right, because you got to learn. Wow. It took you 20 years, you're 20 years of smoking, 30 years of smoking, and you think you're going to do it in a day? Sometimes that doesn't work. So if they follow those 5 simple letters or those 5 little steps, they actually can better themselves during Ramadan, after Ramadan, or even, let's talk about it right now, start doing it now before Ramadan.
Absolutely. And also, I'm keen to know your thoughts on this as well in the UAE, because a lot of people I hear say that here in the country, obviously compared to other parts of the world, smoking is cheaper here. And also you can still smoke in many places. Do you think that's something that it's hard to overcome when you're trying to kick the habit, when you can go to restaurants, etc., and you can still smoke indoors and it doesn't, you know, set you back many, many dirhams to buy a packet?
Yeah. So the reality is that it is harder, I will admit, especially if you're trying to actually try to avoid it in general, because there are smokers that will tell you, if I smell it, my God, the urge is overwhelming and I really feel like I have to have a cigarette. I always tell my patients, please avoid yourself, avoid situations, people, or anything that you can that may trigger you to want to smoke. Now, if you are forced to go into situations where I'm going to have dinner with my friends, they all smoke, they're going to be smoking in front of me, I always tell my patients, make sure you make them aware that you have quit or you're trying to quit. You need their support. If they don't want to support you, then those are definitely not people you want to be around. Now, if we eliminate that side, we go to the other aspect. Do I think that we need to be stricter and try to make better guidelines? I think this great country of the UAE has tried. I think we are pushing in that direction. I think the health authorities in any types of any emirate is really trying very hard to set the regulations. I will put a specific fact out there. The higher we tax, the more likely people are to quit. And I think that's only my one recommendation that I've told a lot of my colleagues in the health authorities. I think we've raised the tax well, but I think we need to raise it and tax them more. I think we need to be much more stricter on public areas that should be smoke-free and individuals get away. And so that's just my own advocate way of pronouncing it, and my health authority colleagues already know that because I'm a strong advocate of always trying to make this a smoke-free UAE.
During Ramadan as well, when perhaps you're going through those that period of giving up and you're been really committed, a lot of questions get asked about, well, can I still have shisha and certain things like that. What are your thoughts on that, especially obviously during Ramadan when everybody comes together after sunset?
Yeah, so that's a great question because I always get that question all the time. And, you know, listen, I'll always say this. All forms of smoking are harmful for anyone. I mean, the main thing is what we want to put out there is specific facts about shisha, and I'll throw in midwah because midwah is the other option because it's not like a cigarette. These are something that are a little bit more cultural, adapted to the Middle East. Shisha and midwah all have the same types of chemicals. Tobacco is tobacco, okay? The sad thing is that many people don't know, but we're actually discussing this now. There's a huge midwah conference that we're talking about now, and we're finding out the midwah is definitely proven to be stronger than a cigarette. So one puff of midwah is equivalent to three, some people have said even five cigarettes.
Wow.
A sitting with shisha, one sitting, the nicotine levels are extremely high, sometimes even equivalent to like 100 cigarettes. And it's not really just the nicotine, Tom. It's actually the carbon monoxide. Carbon monoxide is actually the smoke. Sure, I am enjoying the nicotine. It's getting into my brain. I am relaxing. But I'm taking in this carbon monoxide, which we know is a poisonous gas.
Yeah.
And the carbon monoxide that comes off of a shisha is like a Ferrari going 160 kilometers and the person sucking on the pipe, the tailpipe of that, and taking in all that smoke. So when people tell me, what do you think about that as an option? I think with my statistics I just presented to you, it's not a viable option. Tom, you can always change a hamburger or a steak to a salad. You can always change juice or Pepsi to water. But there's no difference between tobacco forms, no matter what you do. And the best thing to do is, if you smoke, is to not smoke. It's the best thing you can ever do for your life.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Good afternoon. Hello, it's Tom Bushell here in for Helen Farmer. This hour is all about healthy habits. And we've been speaking to Iyad Hassan from the Cleveland Clinic Abu Dhabi about the art of stopping smoking. Iyad is a tobacco treatment specialist. And for the next 15 minutes or so, we actually have a smoker in Dubai on the line who is keen to ask Iyad a few questions. And I'll introduce him to you now. Alan, hello, good afternoon.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I was going to say brave, but you're keen just to come on air and talk about your nasty smoking habit.
Well, now you said it that way, yes. Make me feel right at home.
I'm with you, Alan. I'm with you. It's a really tough one to get rid of. And, you know, for those that have sort of been caught in the trap, it's a real battle, isn't it, over the years. But there is light at the end of the tunnel, and that's what you're looking for today.
Yeah, my biggest thing is when I started smoking extremely young, back in 1987, because then it was kind of glamorous and social, so you're part of the in crowd if you smoked, as opposed to now. And then it kind of just, it obviously grows and it becomes the habit that it is. And the worst thing I ever did, well, at the time was the best thing, was I gave up. And I gave up for 3 years. And then that one moment where stresses in life, etc., took over, and I just grabbed one cigarette, and that was it. Yeah. That was 20 years ago.
How did you stop for those 3 years? What technique did you use? One of the ways when I was smoking was the Alan Carr book, which worked wonders for me.
Oh yeah, Yeah, I know. I did patches, the nicotine patches, and they worked. And I was always told not to give up things at the same time. Mm. I was living in Australia and moved house, and so I was in like temporary accommodation. So I was like, there's a stress of house moving. There's I decided to give up coffee, and I decided to give up smoking at the same time and substituted with patches. I mean, you didn't want to be around me, I can tell you that much. I was not a pleasant human being at all.
Often a side effect, not. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, I put it down to that. That's still my blame today.
Yeah.
And then I did the patches and I did the gum, and it worked a treat. But the biggest problem, and I guess the biggest question that I had with it was, I'm quite a small human being. I mean, back then I weighed about 70 kilos, and I changed and substituted cigarettes for food. Now, obviously, I chose the wrong food because I ballooned at 91 kilos.
Wow.
In the space of about 9 months, because I just chose fatty food. So the substitute for smoking was eating. So the question I guess I would have is, what should you be doing there? I mean, I just went for my comfort food.
Well, we have Iyad still on the line, and so you can have a conversation now. And that's a good point to start off with, isn't it, Iyad? Is when you stop smoking that those substitutes come into your life, but is there a better way of doing it?
Yeah. So, Alan, first of all, thanks for taking the time to actually letting me talk to you on air, because that's actually a good sign for me that shows you got a lot of confidence. So I'm very proud of you.
Thank you.
So just to put that out there. So look, the main thing, we can deal with that topic as it is, but I'm going to do it. It's like I usually just say, I usually start off, I want to treat this like if you were in my office right now. So as I'd say, hi, my name is Dr. Iyad Hassan. I'm a board-certified family practitioner, but I also am a tobacco treatment specialist. At the same point, I'm also a former smoker like you. Okay, and sadly, why it was easier for you to quit is similar. Australia, I'm very proud of you guys. You guys have strong tobacco regulations on a lot of your stuff, and it's already incorporated in your brain the importance of quitting smoking. For me, my friend, I actually vomited blood, and I gave up after that. I never looked back from it. But that was in 2002. Do I still dream about it, or do I still have feelings at times? It will never go away. It gets easier, but it never goes away, and it's similar to anything else. Now, to start off real quick, before we get into the question about the food, what I got is you started in 1987, which I was very happy to hear. You quit for 3 years. Stress was the number one trigger. The substitute became food. On top of it, just real quick, how much did you smoke a day about?
Oh, back then would have been a packet of 25, I would say, and maybe I'd get a second pack on the way home just in case.
Okay, all right. And you've tried patches, you've tried gum, I heard that. The quick medical question from your side is, just real quick, how soon after did you wake up did you smoke?
First thing,
okay. So literally the pack is by your bed, or you right away you knew where it was?
No, my habit was get up, walk into the room, the living room, walk outside, don't smoke inside. That's the one good thing I have. But the thing is, it could be 4 o'clock in the morning, it could be 3 o'clock in the morning, it could be six. It's just the first thing I do.
Okay.
That's the coffee.
And the coffee. So that was my next question. Next question is, after every meal as dessert?
Yeah, sometimes if I'm out between courses.
Okay. And if there was one emotion, whether it was boredom, anxiety, or depression and like sadness, which one would you definitely smoke? I mean, all three usually trigger a smoke, but which one for sure was one of your main triggers?
Anxiety, definitely. Yep, I just needed to take a walk, but I'd take a walk with a cigarette.
Okay, so here's how it usually goes, Alan, and for all the listeners out there, this is how literally you have to understand. See, Alan, you're addicted and your body's addicted. As Tom and I had discussed a little bit, if you were hearing, you mentally are addicted to it and you are physically addicted to it. So the physical addiction is, of course, the drive. Usually nicotine stays within your body. If you're a cigarette smoker, and a lot of the research is demonstrating similar to Midwest, it's within every 2 hours you would need a cigarette, physiologically.
Correct.
Sometimes you can even distract it, right? Okay.
Yes.
And sadly, you only really need a few puffs, but usually you take 10 puffs a cigarette. With that being said, I always try to tell patients, it's, listen, first of all, you need to celebrate what you did before. My man, 3 years, that's an amazing, amazing thing. Okay? You were doing it. And you already knew what the one trigger was, which was what? Stress. So we, if in our type of clinic that we have here at the Cleveland Clinic, we would work a little bit more on giving you stress, you know, relievers, or try to do it. For individuals like you with food, the food trigger, or as it would be meals and everything, I would say a few things. Brush your teeth. Either slip in a mint, like a high peppermint, spearmint, or cinnamon type of, or hot cinnamon candies that triggers your brain to release the drug called dopamine. Remember how I said your body was addicted to it? Your body is addicted to this hormone called dopamine. And I don't want to complicate the situation, but there's other things in the world that trigger dopamine. So in the end, for people who are addicted to actually having a cigarette after a meal, besides brushing and using Listerine to do it, small pieces of candy with those high peppermint, spearmint, or cinnamon usually help.
That's a very good tip. You know, Alan, I have a challenge for you. Do you reckon you can quit in the next ad break? Which is we've got a couple of minutes. When we come back, are you going to be a non-smoker?
I can guarantee I will not have one during the next ad break.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Good afternoon. Hello, it's Tom Bushell here in for Helen Farmer. We're talking about quitting smoking.
Healthy habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
So we have Alan on the line, who is a smoker in Dubai, and Iyad Hassan as well from the Cleveland Clinic in Abu Dhabi. Alan, have you quit? Are you now a non-smoker after a couple of minutes of an ad break?
Well, ironically, I was doing my shopping list before, and I just added candy and peppermint.
There you go. It's working already. Iyad, we just have a couple of minutes, but just one sort of final little tip, if you like, for Alan, just to sort of send him on the right path, if you can.
Alan, you've already done it. You know how to get there. It's the hardest part. The few things I will tell you real fast in these few minutes. One, please document and list how much you smoke each day or when you smoke. I know it sounds petty, but it will really open your eyes. And a quick habit, especially with it, exercise is the easy one. Each step you take can get you to be tobacco-free. So to replace instead of food, walk around your table a million times. It'll help you. And the last thing to do is, remember, you can always come to our clinic, or if you have or find a clinic anywhere throughout the UAE. Really, I think if you help manage with a little bit of your stress, which sadly with COVID, it doesn't work out so well, but it's managing our stress within COVID. I really do believe that's probably your biggest trigger, my friend. And I mean, again, I've just gotten to know you in these 3 minutes. So writing it down, exercising by walking, and going to a great support program or finding one online or as an app, I really do believe you can be successful.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for coming on, Alan. I hope you feel more positive. Best of luck going forwards as well.
Thank you so much, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Great stuff. Thank you so much, Alan. And Iyad, it's been a pleasure speaking to you over the last hour. We've had so many SMSs and calls. Sadly, not time to go through all of them. But please, can you give us your contact details just so people do know how to get in touch with you?
Sure. You can find me, if not in the primary care offices here, you can find me in the pulmonary clinic at Cleveland Clinic Abu Dhabi. Our phone number is 02-501-9000, or you can look up www.clevelandclinicabudhabi.ae. If you call them, just ask them you'd like to go to the smoking cessation clinic in the pulmonary department, and they will try to set you up with an appointment.
Perfect. Thank you so much for your time today, Iyad. It's great to have you on.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me. And good luck to all the smokers who want to quit during Ramadan.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm sure with your insights, it will be just that little bit easier.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Good afternoon. Hello, it's Tom Bushell here in for Helen Farmer. Let's talk vaccines to begin with. I had my second dose of Senapharm this morning. Thankfully for me, I haven't experienced any side effects. And it's just rather reassuring to be fully vaccinated. It, of course, takes a few weeks for that to take 100% effect on you, but it's nice to have the second one. The latest vaccine figures in the UAE are 86 per 100 in the country have been vaccinated, which is hugely encouraging. And also, Many people are still asking the question, however, about side effects, because it is, of course, depending on which vaccines you are getting, one of the many topics that we are adjusting to. And to speak more on the COVID-19 vaccines, we do have Dr. Nahida Amin Ali, the Chief of Staff at Mediclinic City Hospital, on the phone. Good afternoon to you, Doctor.
Good afternoon, Tom. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Feeling in a positive mood, if you like, after getting that second vaccine this morning. Thanks so much for joining us today, because, as I say, it is a hot topic at the moment. I seem to, whenever I have sort of conversations with friends, the question is, did you have any side effects and how was it? You know, what can you tell us about the side effects to the vaccines? I think it's first and foremost, we should say how, you know, it's very normal and it's nothing to be alarmed by. But why is this happening, would you say, these side effects that many people are getting?
So when we're given a vaccine, we're given the actual illness, so it's an inactivated form of the illness. So our body's introduced to like a killed version of the virus, and the different vaccines that are available on the market will be different types. So your body sees this as a foreign body and it mounts an immune response and it makes antibodies, and that is what makes you feel unwell, because your body's trying to fight off the inactivated form of the virus. And the reason why we like that is when your body sees this, then it makes the antibodies. Then it also keeps some of these antibodies as a memory. So if in 6 months' time or kind of in a year's time, you actually get the actual illness and you catch it, you've already got these memory cells and you can quickly fight off the illness without it making you more unwell.
Yeah, sure. And I think just from what you've said as well, and this is just popping into my mind now, I think we should also make sure that people aren't worried if they don't have side effects. Because as you say, getting those side effects is a good sign that the virus is, the vaccine is working, and there is that tiny small amount of the virus in your body, which is then creating those antibodies. But if you don't have any side effects, that is not something to be concerned about.
No, it's just everyone's different and we're all different. Some of us will get more side effects than others. It's just the way our body is responding to it. It's the same as there are people who will take the test for COVID, a PCR, and it's positive, yet they're feeling completely fine. They do have the virus, yet they've got no symptoms. So it's the same with the vaccine. Everyone responds differently. Just because you haven't had any side effects doesn't mean you haven't got the immunity.
Yeah. What should you do when you experience the side effects? I mean, is it a case of just almost treating it as though you are, you know, you are unwell, you're under the weather, so it's a case of, you know, getting some rest, staying in bed, sleeping it off over a couple of days?
Yeah, the most common side effects are generally mild, so you might get a bit of pain or swelling in the area where you had the vaccine given, mild fever, feeling a bit tired. I mean, when I had my vaccine, I had a bit of a headache, felt a bit achy. I still managed to continue to work. I took a paracetamol. I mean, if it makes you feel more well, just rest. You know, you could have a rest at home, drink plenty of fluids, and just look after yourself.
What about the difference?
More than that.
Yeah. What about the difference in vaccines as well? Because I guess, certainly from my experience, I hear sort of different stories with depending on what vaccine you have. You know, some seem to cause more side effects than others. Is there anything you can tell us on that? Is there a reason for that, why some vaccines may cause more of a side effect?
Yeah, we are seeing some of the vaccines are causing more side effects. And it's probably because with this current vaccine for COVID, we've got different types of vaccines, i.e. we've got different types of technology, like we've got the what we call the mRNA for some of our vaccine, and the Sinopharm one is a different one. So the way our body is responding is a little bit different. Whereas other vaccines, when we have, for example, for typhoid, it's the same one, and it's not, it gives you the same response, because we've got slightly different ways of the way the vaccines are made, hence we're seeing the different responses to each vaccine.
Mm. And I wonder as well if anxiety, in a way, plays a part. Almost expecting to get side effects before you have your dose, and then, you know, it's that whole mind game, isn't it? If you think you're going to get ill, you get ill. Do you think that plays a part?
I think that's a really important point you made there, Tom. I mean, I'm family medicine background, and we can't underestimate psychologically how you're feeling, how it will impact on you, and you will actually feel symptoms, and they will feel real. But it does have a big impact. So if we can feel a bit more relaxed and not get as anxious, it will make a difference.
Yeah. I remember when I went for my first dose 3 weeks ago or so there, because I have some food allergies, I had the Sinopharm vaccine, and I was very aware that I wasn't able to have the Pfizer vaccine because of those food allergies. So I was quite surprised when I was asked if I did have any food allergies. And in fact, when I said I did, I was told to stay there at the vaccine centre for half an hour or so, just so that they could monitor me. Well, in those opening sort of minutes after having the vaccine. But it's important to remember as well that you're in safe hands. You know, there are emergency services around should anything happen that's out of the ordinary.
Yeah, and with any vaccine that we give, we always kind of for 5 minutes or 2 minutes, we normally, when the young kids are having it, we always observe them. With the COVID vaccine, when we were delivering it at City, we normally make the patient stay for 20 minutes. We're just being a little bit more cautious because it is something new, and it's better for us to keep you there for 20 minutes, make sure everything is okay, because if you're going to get anything severe, a reaction is going to happen more or less kind of within the first half an hour.
Yeah.
And I think it's just good practice. And then it puts the patient at ease that it's been half an hour, 20 minutes, I'm feeling fine.
Mm.
And then we're all happy.
Absolutely. Zina, have you been vaccinated?
I got the first jab at the end of January, actually.
Okay. And which one did you have?
I got the Sinopharm jab.
Okay. Yeah. So same as me. And any side effects for you?
Absolutely no side effects. Unfortunately, I got COVID a week later.
Ah,
yeah.
Right. So hence why you haven't had your second one.
Exactly.
Okay.
And actually, I wanted to ask the doctor if, if I've still got antibodies. Is it 3 months after the recovery, or can I get my second jab right away?
Okay, you need to, because we've been giving out the Pfizer vaccine, so I have more experience with that. At first, it was 3 months, but then the guidance has changed and it went down to 10 days. So just double check with the vaccination center. But we don't have to wait the full 3 months now. As we're getting more used to the vaccine and we're giving it out and data is being collected, the guidance has changed. I know for Pfizer it was down to, it could be after 10 days. If you're symptoms free, you could have your vaccine. But for Sinopharm, just check that, because I haven't actually been giving that out here in Dubai, so I have less experience with that.
Thanks, doctor. Just wondering, so I had my first jab on the 28th of January. Has the time period lapsed? Should I be repeating my jab? I know, you said you handled Pfizer, but just in general.
Okay, now, generally, for the vaccine to be kind of valid here, we say up to 42 days. And if it's beyond that, then you'll have to have a discussion with the doctor to see whether you need to start again. But that's just for Dubai. If you look at the international evidence, and my background is from the UK, you actually can wait more than even 3 months and then have your second dose. As far as we know about vaccines, even if they are delayed, it still gives you cover. What you can't do is have it early.
One of the questions as well, which I think would be handy to dive into, is changing your vaccine product. So I think it's obviously very, it's recommended to have your first and second dose has to be the same product. But going forwards, if we're going to be talking about doing, having to get vaccinated each year, for instance, is it a case of staying with the same one? Or can you chop and change as the years go by, depending on how long we'll be taking vaccines?
Yeah, that's a really interesting. Currently, the guidance is to stay with the same one. But I was actually reading something, and nothing's been published here, so this is just kind of unofficial guidance. Some people are saying if you haven't had a response and you've had two doses and you feel like you haven't got the antibodies or you haven't got the response, then you may have to switch. But if you've had two, like I've had two of the Pfizer vaccine and everything is fine, if I need a booster, I will stick with the Pfizer.
Yeah, it's the booster side of things, isn't it? If you're having a vaccine 6 months later as a booster, should you stick with the same one? But as you say, this is a new world we're living in, and we're all sort of learning on the spot. So more on that as we go further and onwards. But one thing as well, I mean, how the UAE is doing a remarkable job in rolling these vaccines out there. This morning at Dubai Parks, I was, and it was just a really smooth process. It was, I queued up for about 10 minutes in the car, then let through, parked, and then straight in, token number, quick registration, and then in and out in a matter of 20 minutes. I mean, it really is testament, isn't it, here to how good this rollout system has been in the UAE.
Yeah, I think absolutely we've done a phenomenal job. You know, the figures that you were seeing, kind of 86%, absolutely amazing. I mean, I'm so proud that we're living here in the UAE. You really have done a good job when it's come to the vaccination. And now it doesn't matter whether you have an illness or not or what age you are. They really have opened it up to everybody. A UAE resident, you'll get the vaccine.
Yeah.
We are very lucky to be here.
Absolutely. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer. Join the conversation on Dubai Eye 103.8. And it's Tom Bushell looking after things for Helen Farmer today on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Healthy Habits
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are talking vaccines this afternoon with Dr. Nahidi Amin Ali, the Chief of Staff at Mediclinic City Hospital. And there's plenty of SMSs and phone calls coming in as well. And Doctor, if you don't mind, I'm just going to share a few of these with you just so we can give some insights to those listening today. The first one here, which is actually a really, really good point from Lena. My entire family got COVID 3 days after getting the first jab. They thought the symptoms were just side effects. But how do you tell the difference between it being a side effect after that first vaccine or actually being the symptoms and actually having the virus?
Generally, if you're going to get side effects, they tend to be more milder and they typically should last 2 to 3 days and then they really should settle. Anything beyond that, and that's not normal for a vaccine side effect, that's when you need to go and see a doctor and get a full assessment.
Another one here. I had my first AstraZeneca vaccine on the 15th of February. The second dose is scheduled for the 26th of April. But this person is asking if they can delay that second dose because it falls within Ramadan. And as he needs a paracetamol the day after the vaccine, he won't be able to do that whilst fasting. So is it possible to delay the second dose or would you almost need to give it a period of time and then do the two doses, start the course again, if you like?
I would recommend that you stick to the schedule because these vaccines are new and according to the CDC, that's the American guidance, and it is telling us the maximum you could delay it by is up to 42 days. After that, we're not sure how effective the second dose, how much more immunity it will give you. So I would stick to the guidance, and if you're having to kind of not feeling well before you close your fast early in the morning at suhoor time, take your paracetamol then. And if you're not feeling well, you may have to miss one day of fast and then you could always make that up after Ramadan.
Sure. I am a nursing mother. Which vaccine is safest for me? A very popular SMS we're getting this afternoon.
Now, initially, they weren't recommending the vaccines for if you were a nursing mother. But now from the evidence from the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists in the UK, they are recommending that you can have the vaccines. And I know the Pfizer one now, before it wasn't, but now is available if you're a breastfeeding mum. So if you want to have a look, just go on to the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists website. In the UK, it's available to the public as well. And you'll be able to have a look at that and even read of the guidance so you're better informed when you're making your choice.
But also,
breastfeeding isn't a reason not to have it.
Yeah. I know, obviously, we have the vaccines available here in the UAE, the AstraZeneca, Sinopharm, Pfizer. Do you know of any plans to bring any more of the vaccine products here to the UAE? Because I know some people are struggling to or not able to have the ones that we do have available here. And I think it sort of can make people a little bit anxious in terms of when we're talking about vaccine passports potentially becoming a big part of our life if we want to travel again. And there's a worry that if you can't have the vaccine that is available in your home country or where you're living, then there's a worry then you won't be able to travel. And I think that's high on the agenda of a lot of people when they want to get home as soon as they can to see family and what have you that they haven't seen for a long time.
It's a difficult one to answer because all the vaccines aren't bought in by private health organisations. They're actually bought in by the government. So if it's Abu Dhabi, it's by SIHA, and if here in Dubai, it's by the DHA. I mean, initially, we only had a few vaccines and they bought in more. I predict eventually all vaccines probably will be made available. But how long that will take, we don't know. So unless it's a real contraindication of where you can't have the vaccines currently available, I wouldn't wait around because we don't know how long it will take.
Yeah.
I would encourage people to get vaccinated because we've got better immunity, and kind of the more of us that are vaccinated, the better it is. Then we build up that herd immunity.
Yeah, for sure. Dr. Nahida, it's been fabulous to talk to you this afternoon. I think just to end on one point as well, it's worth mentioning the last year has been, you know, we've been so cautious about being careful, washing hands, face masks on, social distancing as well. But it is important to remember, once you are fully vaccinated, and there's obviously that period of time after the second one where essentially those antibodies are properly in your system, but it's worth pointing out to still keep on with those procedures and those, you know, face mask on, social distancing, just in case you are still able to pick up that virus.
Yeah, I mean, the vaccine will give us immunity, but, you know, nothing is ever 100%. So keeping the face mask on, doing the social distancing, we can't move away from that. Not at the moment. Maybe in another year's time or however long it takes us, we may get back to walking around with our face mask. But at the moment, I would kind of encourage that we stick to the safety measures that are in place.
Yeah, good words indeed. Dr. Nahidi, thank you so much for your time this afternoon and being with us on Dubai Eye 103.8. Have a good rest of your day.
Okay, thank you. Take care.
Thank you so much.
Join the conversation on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Today, April the 6th, is International Tartan Day. Yes, that is a thing. And as there are many Celts in the UAE, it's only fair to mark the day. Tartan Day was created to celebrate Scottish history and is celebrated by Scots all over the world. But what is the history of tartan? Where did the kilt come from, and where can you get your hands on a kilt in Dubai? To answer such questions, we have Calvin, who is the co-owner of Suited and Booted here in Dubai, on the line. Good afternoon, Calvin.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having us on.
Absolute pleasure. That is a Scottish accent, if I've ever heard one.
Yeah, you can't hide it, unfortunately.
No need to hide. I have a little bit of Scottish blood in me, but I love the Scottish accent, so I wish I had more of a Scottish accent. So, International Tartan Day, Calvin, today. Are you sold out of kilts? Was there a rush for people buying kilts today?
I don't think we've sold any specifically for National Tartan Day, but we have seen a huge increase in popularity in the region recently, actually.
Yeah, so why do you think that is? Because, of course, the thing with the kilt is it's a heavy garment, and it's not something you would necessarily want to wear in the heat of Dubai.
Of course, but I mean, because Dubai is such a transient place, you know, a huge number of our clients are travelling all over the world for weddings and stuff like that, so we've just seen a huge increase in the sort of people that are getting them with the ability to sort of travel back to their home countries.
Yeah, and I mean they're wonderful, wonderful outfits to put on for a special occasion. I've been to many weddings or birthdays, things like that, and had the full kilt on back in Scotland. But can you tell us what the history of tartan is, and where did it all begin?
Yeah, so tartan itself sort of dates back to like the 3rd or the 4th century, the actual pattern itself. And there's like sort of records as far back as that. But the actual kilt itself, that sort of came into about the 16th century, and it was actually sort of adopted by Scots as a sort of everyday dress.
Mm. And on that point, why was it adopted? Does it come back to being warm and keeping warm? I say that, but essentially it is a skirt, so I don't know how warm it would actually keep you.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I don't think anyone would know 100%, but I think that would have been just the initial thing, obviously, because like you said, it's a heavy fabric. That would have probably been to keep warm in the cold Scottish winter.
Yeah. Yeah, I've worn a kilt in Scotland in the winter at a friend's wedding in December. Chris Bacardi was there as well, actually, who, of course, is on the radio after 5 o'clock. And I have to say, I mean, it was freezing, absolutely freezing. But you have to, if you're going to wear a kilt, you have to wear them properly, don't you?
Yeah, that's true. And there's a few different traditions that go along with that, but I'll leave you to discuss that one.
Talk to us about the different tartan patterns that you can get. I mean, I think, people will know sort of some of the patterns, and I think Stuart is the most well-known one, isn't it?
Yeah, Stuart's the most well-known one, obviously, because it's synonymous with the royal family. But there's like sort of Black Watch tartan, Ramsay tartan are the most well-known ones. But there's so many modern tartans now, which are tend to be more popular, unless obviously some people go for their family tartan for obvious reasons.
Yeah, and of course it's suited and booted. You can buy your kilts there. You don't rent them out, do you? It's just a case of buying your kilts. I mean, there can't be many places in Dubai that sells kilts. So if you want your kilt, you get to suited and booted. And you guys, how do you go about sort of, is it like a suit? It's a normal fitting process to make sure you've got everything right?
Yeah, all of the kilts that we make are bespoke kilts, like totally made by hand from scratch. And to my knowledge, we're the only place in the UAE that actually produces kilts made to measure.
And are you making simply the skirt part of it, or the whole, you know, the jacket,
everything,
the socks, the lot, the boron?
Yeah,
sporran.
We do absolutely everything. So the whole jacket, waistcoat, and the kilt itself is all made by hand in our workshop in Dubai.
And what kind of price ranges are we looking at for a kilt then to buy one here in Dubai with suited and booted? I mean, I'd imagine you can keep them as basic as anything, right up to all the accessories and all singing and all dancing.
Exactly, yeah, there's a huge range. I mean, just for the kilt itself, it's about 4,000 dirhams, but for the whole everything with the sporting and the skiing doing everything, it's about 7K.
Okay. Do you know what? I'm tempted. Zina, are you a fan of the kilt?
Yeah, I mean, I was just Googling men in kilts and just a few male...
Try to think what comes up.
Well, a few really gorgeous male celebrities wearing them.
Yeah.
If you go on Google Images, so Ewan McGregor, Will Smith, Kiefer Sutherland, David Tennant is always seen in a kilt. David Hasselhoff, who knew?
Yeah, I mean, there is that thing where people just wear them because they don't have a connection to Scotland, but they just think they look cool. Yeah,
yeah. We sold loads of kilts to people that have just bought them literally just for a sort of fashion purpose, or like you said, don't even have a Scottish connection, but just love the idea of it.
Calvin, obviously you have a kilt here in Dubai in your wardrobe. Have you often worn it here in the sunshine?
Not for any other reason, unless I'm going to a wedding or something like that. Like you said, it might be a bit warm for the Dubai climate.
Yeah.
Join the conversation on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
International Tartan Day is today, which we are celebrating for a few moments with Calvin, who is the co-owner of Suited and Booted, probably the only place you can actually buy a kilt in Dubai. Calvin, we were saying how it's not common to be wearing a kilt in the sunshine here, but there must be some good stories of people coming to Suited and Booted to buy kilts and to fly away to all sorts of destinations. What sort of people have come in and to actually get some kilts for themselves?
I mean, you can actually get like all the tartan fabrics in different weights, so there is an option to get a slightly more sort of lightweight version for the slightly warmer climates. But we had a client who came in recently. He was actually Jordanian, and his wife, wife that he was getting married to, was Scottish. And he was getting married in the Maldives, and he came down, obviously didn't have a clue about kilts or how to wear them. And he was like, I'm going to get one as a surprise for her. So obviously he's turned up in the Maldives and he's in his full-blown kilt, which I'm sure would have been a bit of a surprise for her.
I feel like everybody is in the Maldives at the moment. It seems to be, I mean, obviously it's one of those destinations we can go to from the UAE, but maybe you'd turn up in the Maldives now and just everyone would be in a kilt there today celebrating International Tartan Day.
It might be catching on, but I'm sure they got lots of brownie points from the family back in Scotland for turning up with the full works on.
Exactly. How many different types of kilts do you have in stock, or how many can you sort of create, if you like, for people asking?
Well, I mean, it's absolutely completely made from scratch by hand, so we do basically anything anybody wants, from down to like young kids, or obviously some women get kilts, and there's a huge range of options, and we can basically get any tartan in the world we can get in stock and sort of made for the individual person.
And a couple of questions here. This is a good one, actually. Do you do small kilts? We have a message from Mark saying he wants one for his wee boy. So do you have small kilts?
Of course, yeah, we can make it to any size whatsoever. So there's no issues with that.
And what are the fundamental accessories you need when wearing a kilt? We talk about the sporran. There's the the little knife. I think there's a better word for it than that. That goes into the stockings. Yeah, tell us what the key accessories are.
Yeah, so like you mentioned there, the sporran, obviously for the front of the kilt, the ski and do, which is the sort of little dagger that goes in your sock.
And
the socks themselves, and then some people would wear like the jacket and the waistcoat and flashes. There's all sort of different variations of the accessories.
Are you a bow tie man?
The sporran and the ski and do is the main one.
Yeah, are you a bow tie man or a tie with a kilt?
I'd probably go more a tie than a bow tie.
Yeah,
myself,
interesting.
Again,
I've always gone bow tie, but I think, yeah, tie could be... I like the idea of the tie, I have to say. Chris has texted, if I order one today, when would it be ready? I mean, I guess obviously you can't just order one. You'd have to come in and get fitted. But how long would the process be in terms of making a kilt?
We can do it in about 3 weeks from start to finish. We need to allow a few days for the fabric to arrive from Scotland. But yeah,
Very good. Not long. Very
good.
Well, Calvin, I wish you and the rest of the team at Suited and Booted a very happy, and I hope you celebrate it correctly, a very happy International Tartan Day today.
Thanks very much, guys, and I'll speak to you soon.
Our pleasure, Calvin. Have a good rest of your day.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's Afternoons with Helen Farmer. With me, Tom Bushell. It is time to talk psychology. And for this, we'll be speaking to Dr. Chasity O'Connell from the Human Relations Institute Clinic. Before we get Dr. Chasity on the line, I read a piece this week, I don't know if you saw this, Sina, that no longer is FOMO a thing, fear of missing out, FOMO. We know that that's sort of in our vocabulary now, nowadays, isn't it? And has been for many a year. The new term is FOGO, which is fear of going out. So not fear of missing out, but fear of going out for obvious reasons. Post-pandemic, we've all got used to being at home too much and getting anxious about going out. So we're going to talk to Dr. Chasity about this. But do you feel like you've got a bit of FOGO, Zina?
Yes. Initially, yeah, when the pandemic, you know, when it started happening in March of 2020, I felt like... oh gosh, I feel like I can't step out. Mm. You know, we had to wear gloves and a mask, and it kind of suffocated me. But now I think I'm back to FOMO again. But I know that a lot of people are still in the FOGO phase.
It's like a seesaw between FOMO and FOGO. What on earth do we do? Dr. Chasity, thank you for joining us on the line this afternoon.
Oh, what a pleasure. Thank you as well.
Thank you. So as you heard, the thing that we've come across this week is this new phrase of FOGO, fear of going out. And as I say, post-pandemic, when we've all got used to being at home, it's a real thing, isn't it, that people are getting anxious about going out, being around people in crowds, socialising. It all makes complete sense that this is a genuine issue that we are now needing to get our heads around.
Yes, definitely. I think that's one of the main sort of things to highlight, is that it is an experience that many people are having, but there are degrees. You could think of it along a spectrum, that some folks are feeling it much more strongly than others. And so for example, if, you know, just to start off with, it's not a diagnosable condition. So you cannot go to your doctor and say, I have FOGO. But what it indicates,
can you go to your doctors and say, I have FOMO?
Oh, you could, but I don't know if they'll give you anything for it. But I think that's what's nice about these words like FOGO, FOMO, JOMO, is that it's making some of these like psychological experiences more accessible and relevant for people. We use the word anxiety a lot. We use the word worry a lot. And so for some folks to have, you know, to be, you know, struggling with things that are going on and hear someone say FOGO, fear of going out, and go, oh my gosh, that's what I'm going through right now, I think can be really validating. But, you know, going back to this not diagnosable condition, it can be in this spectrum of intensity. So you can have FOGO indicating, you know, natural sort of transition feelings around, gosh, I've been living quite a restricted life, and now I have some hesitation and worries about going out due to contracting COVID. Okay, that makes sense. Pretty straightforward. Or it could have a much more sort of nuanced flavor to it, where, you know, maybe social engagements are starting to pick up. And it's like, gosh, you know, I know what my level of risk or my threshold of risk with regard to COVID is. I don't know what this family's is. How do I navigate around this? And so that's more in the like lifestyle management. But then there's FOGO representing something much more clinically significant, where it could be symptomatic of a diagnosable disorder like agoraphobia or social anxiety disorder or obsessive compulsive disorder or panic disorder. And these can have certainly FOGO being a flavor of each one. What makes them a disorder is that they impact a person's ability to function. They're yeah. really distressing. And again, it's not the FOGO that you're diagnosing, but if you fear leaving your home and that you consider that the only safe environment for you, then we are talking about something different. If, you know, for, and that is a reference to agoraphobia. In terms of what FOGO could look like in social anxiety disorder, you know, where in social anxiety disorder, you're talking about fear of being negatively evaluated by others, of being embarrassed and getting things wrong. And so an example of that for some folks might be, let's say you are getting out of your car and you're running into the shop and you forget to put your mask on. Honest mistake, you know, and a couple people see you and you go, oh my goodness, I forgot my mask. And so you run back to the car, which is a natural reaction. But some folks that are struggling with social anxiety disorder might think, oh my gosh, everybody must think I'm the dumbest person ever. They must think that I am the worst. I'm putting other people's lives at risk. I'm just this awful person. And they feel that level of distress really, really intensely. And if you feel that when you go out, that spotlighting effect, that negative evaluation, then it's going to make you a lot less likely to go out. So there's, you know, sort of FOGO. And then there's also FOGO manifested as something I like to call either CBA or MLIDN. These are totally made up acronyms, which is can't be asked, CBA. And then MLIDN is my life is different now. Gosh, I don't like to do the things I once did. It's simpler, you know, I don't have to perform. I don't have all this pressure to show up in the way that I once had to before COVID. So FOGO, and I love that you're discussing and raising awareness about it, because it could be reflective of many different experiences. Yeah.
It's another part of this is, and you're touching on it, is becoming insular. Which we've read about pop stars becoming insular, you know, famous celebrities becoming insular and the pressure getting too much or then just having complete burnout and basically, you know, staying in their house for years on end and eventually they come back and resurrect their careers. But it's almost like that is a thing that we're now all going through is having fallen into these habits of staying in, not thinking about, you know, right, what holiday are we going on next week or in a couple of weeks or what we're going to do at the weekends, etc. People are becoming sort of very accustomed and used to staying in. And the trick, I guess, is we've obviously been out of lockdown here a little longer than maybe most countries around the world who are still battling really hard against this virus. But how do you start to break that habit? And if you have stayed cautious and stayed in more than you normally would have, how do you start to come out of that? And what are the tricks and the habits that you can start to recapture to get yourself out again?
Yeah, definitely. And I think just in Zena's description at the beginning, she said, well, I remember having FOGO, but now I have FOMO. And now it's back to FOGO. Who knows? But you're highlighting this important point that, like, as we come out or emerge from lockdown, like, our experience with integrating in the world is very different. And I think sort of if you look at, you know, do a search on Google of FOGO, you saw a lot of articles coming out in June, July, August of last year. But again, you know, it comes around in cycles of now we're not maybe experiencing as much of the fear about contracting COVID, but more about what you were beautifully describing, which is we've become more insular. Our lives have changed, our habits have changed, and so there is this sort of, you know, values questioning that might need to happen. Like, do I want to go back to where I was, or what does this mean for me now going forward? And, you know, exploring that deliberate or intentionality of, you know, have my social relationships changed? What is it, you know, and you describe burnout. I think a lot of people are burnt out because COVID has taxed them. And so when we're trying to understand how to go forward, it's really important to understand, what is our FOGO? Is it related to fear about COVID? Is it social, you know, has a social anxiousness component to it? Is it, you know, I wasn't really happy before COVID and I'm kind of happy now, but I don't know what that's going to look like. So there's a lot of exploration depending on what your individual experience of FOGO is.
We have an SMS from Lou. You can get in touch on 4001. But Lou says here, I love going out. Obviously, going out, but keeping socially distant and, of course, keeping up with all of the procedures. But I've lost a lot of friends because I love going out. My friends have an unhealthy amount of FOGO and it's affecting their mental health. I'm so careful and will never, you know, step out of my own bubble, but I've been verbally attacked for wanting to go out. What should Lou do in that instance when this, you know, these new thoughts and fears in our own heads are starting to affect friendships?
Oh, such a great question, because I think this is a real flavor of the FOGO struggle. And I think the most important thing is that sort of dialogue and communication. And I think there is this kind of polarity that happened over, you know, what kind of social distancing are you doing? You know, do you wear your mask above your nose or below your nose?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of sort of tension and feelings, heightened feelings around what has happened. And I think as people sort of wrestle with whatever those feelings are and are able to communicate that and sort of understand, okay, well, I can accept this. And, you know, if you're continuing to go out in a way that does not reflect how I want to go out, then what does that mean for our social interaction? Does it mean that we engage mostly at the beach or over Zoom? And so rather than all or nothing, it like now I have these friends, it's like, how can I redefine what this relationship looks like as we're both getting comfortable? So allowing people who are legitimately experiencing anxiety to work through that. They're not at the same place that other people might be. And so there's a lot of juggling. So as I'm describing there's no clear answer. It really is where are people at.
Do you think if people are suffering from FOGO, so if you're just turning on your radio, FOGO is the new phrase of fear of going out after the last year or so that we've been through. But do you think if you are suffering from FOGO, a good way to go about going back out and starting to change those habits of being indoors a lot is perhaps not to be going out with a group of people, but maybe just one friend or a couple of friends, and maybe doing something a little bit differently where certainly for me over the last year, I've done a lot of hiking, a lot of kayaking, a lot of these big, great outdoors adventures. I started a website on it called thesportsexplorer.com. But those sort of things where you're actively moving, and we'll get onto this in a bit in a moment as well, but physical exercise with a friend in small groups can be a nice way to ease back into socializing.
Absolutely. So looking at the most important thing is starting where you're at. So if you have been having these like socially distant, you know, activities where you are going for walks outdoors, you're meeting at the beach, you're meeting at the desert, and it's all, you know, a question of how much more engagement would you like and what is sort of legally and socially acceptable as well, what are the restrictions? So it's important to be mindful of that.
Yeah.
But if you have not gone out and you are sort of wanting and trying, then it might be starting off going for a walk by yourself, you know, depending again on how. So it's where you're at and you know, challenging that within a reasonable frame. So, you know, not going from, we haven't really been going out, we've only been hanging out in our back garden, to going to the mall at 3 p.m. on a Friday. Not recommending that, but maybe you start with going for a walk in your neighborhood. Maybe you start by sitting on the beach for a bit.
Yeah.
Maybe you look at outdoor malls. Like there's some wonderful outdoor malls here where, you know, if you're concerned about ventilation and those sort of things, you can really just build up your tolerance for that distress. Because if we're talking about you know, is this a lifestyle change? Like, my life is different now, or is this, you know, I really do want to be doing more. I'm just so scared. And if that's what's guiding you, if it's the fear that's guiding you, then that's something we can work through. And the way you described it, by, you know, baby steps of exposing yourself, and that's what we use to treat phobias, is exposure therapy. Baby steps of exposure can be immensely helpful, and there is a way forward to it.
Dr. Chasity O'Connell from the Human Relations Institute Clinic talking to us for psychology this afternoon. One here, COVID seems to have exaggerated the difference between extroverts and introverts. What do you say to that?
So it's an interesting one when we talk about introversion versus extroversion, because those are personality traits. And I think what ends up happening is that sometimes introversion gets confused with things like shyness or loneliness or social anxiety. But introversion is not, just like extroversion, a diagnosable condition or problematic. We know there are a number of environments and circumstances, management being one of them, where introverts thrive, according to the research. So, but we know that personality traits also can shift. And so it's not like what you're stuck with is going to, but there is some stability to it. So has, I would say in many ways, COVID has shifted how we, you know, sort of feed our personality traits or how we enact our social, our personality traits. So with extroversion, you know, how have extroverts accommodated their extroversion and still maintained that kind of interaction that they've needed, you know, to feel fed in the same way introverts, how do they interact and get that time away to regroup as well. So it's important to make the distinction that introversion is not in and of itself, but have we shifted over time how we interact with other people? How have we accommodated our personality traits? Absolutely. There have been shifts. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Charlotte here says, I have FOGO, fear of going out, and it's affecting my relationship with my kids and husband. They think I'm being difficult and silly, but I've had a loss in the family due to COVID complications back in the UK. And I guess I'm still grieving. How would I get out of this slump, says Charlotte?
Sure. So here's what, and thank you, Charlotte, for sharing your story and your experiences. So there's FOGO as FOGO, but FOGO on its own doesn't, you know, exist without the complication of other life variables. And one of them is that COVID has directly or indirectly touched so many of us in terms of loss. And that loss during COVID can feel very different than loss pre-COVID. We might have gone to funerals. We've gotten together in big groups. We've sat around talking, sharing, eating, processing that loss. Whereas with COVID, we have our loved ones dying in isolation, and that is extremely painful and traumatizing for many people, the idea of not being able to have that. So I would say, you know, the sort of feelings, the pain, the hesitation is a part of the grieving process. It's very complicated. Be gentle with yourself, family, be gentle. And what you're doing is trying to find that way forward. And unfortunately, again, because of that remoteness, COVID can really, the circumstances around COVID can really interrupt the grieving process.
For sure.
So that's one thing I will say.
Dr. Chatterjee, thank you so much for your time today. Just before I let you go, what would you say for you? I mean, it's a case of everyone's different, isn't it? And you have to work out your own way to go back into normal life, which is, you know, the new normal, if you like. For me, it was very much getting out and going hiking and doing things like that. But for you, what would you say is one great tip for people who are struggling just to bring themselves out of being indoors and to get back out there?
Sure. So with the struggle, acknowledge it's important to kind of, rather than sometimes when we're struggling with something, we can be extremely harsh, critical, and judgmental of ourselves.
Yeah.
And so I think the first step is to cultivate that voice of compassion that you are doing the best that you can and you're trying to find your way through this. That helps take the pressure down several notches, which can help you, of course, do the things that you want. Ask yourself before you do things, and if something really, you've been invited somewhere, ask yourself, what's guiding this decision? Is it fear? Is it that I'm afraid of I'm going to get COVID? Is it I've lost my social stomach? Is it I don't want to really do this right now? If it's fear, then that might signal it's something to work on. If it's, I don't know if I want to do this, and it sounds like some other stuff has gotten stirred up, which it has during the process of COVID with our relationships.
Indeed.
So ask yourself, what's driving me right now?
Dr. Chasity, thank you so much for your time today. A pleasure to have you on the radio.
Oh, you are so welcome. It's been really lovely having this time with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's Afternoons with Helen Farmer. With me, Tom Bushell. Thank you so much for your company today. Now, today, April the 6th, is a day around the world where the advantages of playing sport and being active are celebrated. It is known as International Day of Sport for Development and Peace. The day was created to remember the first day of the first ever Olympics, which was today in 1896 in, of course, Greece. And it is designed to drive social change, community development, and foster peace and understanding. More than ever now, of course, participating in sporting activities and being active is hugely important in the way we live our lives, especially as we fight through this time of a pandemic. To talk more on this, the founder of Do Plays, a well-known sporting activity brand over the years here in the UAE, Ravi Basari, joins me on the phone. Hello, Ravi. How are you?
Yeah, I'm well, thanks. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Thank you for joining us this afternoon on this day where the advantages of playing sport and being active is recognised. We've been talking psychology for the past 30 minutes or so, and there is no doubting the effects of staying active has its advantages. But just how high on the agenda of the way we live our lives would you put playing sport, socialising through sport, and being active, especially in these times?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and I think the answer is pretty obvious. It's super important. We are all social beings, and especially in a city that we are adopted in, it's tough to meet others and find places to play sport. I think everyone has realized during these lockdowns and this pandemic that the need to get out there and be human and interact with people and run around and break a sweat and be healthy and play sport is super needed. And so, super fundamental, I think, to what we all aspire and want to get back to doing. And it's just a question of when we can do it safely.
Absolutely. And I mean, once, after the UAE came through that lockdown period and we started to be able to venture out a little bit more, of course, taking in social distancing and all of that. But tell me, since we emerged from those lockdown periods here in the UAE, have you seen higher demand in people wanting to take part in outdoor, specifically sporting activities, with the idea of being outdoors being a lot safer than being indoors?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we're blessed with good weather here for most of the year, and being outside now is still relatively good weather-wise. So people want to play. They want to get back outside. They've been cooped up for, most of the pandemic. I think there is still a little bit of reticence or kind of anxiety of sweating against someone or kind of posting up to someone if you're playing basketball or more kind of contact-heavy sport. But people are super excited to want to be back outside and meet their friends. And, sports and team sports specifically, it is as much sort of a social outlet as it is a sports or kind of exercise outlet, maybe versus other things people can do around fitness. And so I think people are very keen just to meet their friends and get back into playing the team sport that they grew up playing and have sort of stopped playing because of the last couple of months.
Yeah, and I think it is also seeing a change in trends, whereas before it would be quite common to go out for a meal or a bite to eat with friends, whereas now seeing your friends, you can actually, it's almost a lot more, people want to do it a lot more, socialise with their friends, but whilst being active and whilst playing sport. And you see that just, with the likes of walking along Kite Beach these days, or, places like that in Dubai where there's sports courts and facilities and it's friends coming together to play together, as opposed to, perhaps going to a restaurant or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you see a lot more kind of outdoor paddle tennis courts now. So people are playing 2-on-2, beach volleyball down at Kite Beach. Some of the schools that are right now being permitted to be able to offer their facilities, in the evenings, on weekends, as long as it's socially distanced. So, I think when it comes to COVID and people doing things online and Zoom calls and ordering food and doing online fitness classes, you know, that's great and people have adjusted, but there is no kind of alternative to kicking a football or shooting a basketball or throwing a frisbee. So everyone's just kind of chomping at the bit to get back to playing.
You mentioned paddle tennis there. I've absolutely fallen in love with that sport over the last couple of years. It's a brilliant game, isn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing. And, you know, it's something that, you know, I believe here has been triggered and sort of driven and popularized through, His Highness Sheikh Hamdan's love for the game. So there are a couple of great private courts as well as a lot of public courts now, courtesy of Dubai. And so it's neat to see that game take off. I think it's also really popular in sort of Latin America and in Spain in particular. It's a lot more fun if you're a tennis player because you actually get to have a rally going. And it is social, right? You're playing 2-on-2 and you can sort of chat in between, I guess, serves. So, paddle is, I think, one of the fastest growing sports globally, and as well as here in the UAE.
Yeah, it's great. I know it's a doubles game, but I have played paddle tennis as singles before, which is quite a workout.
Yeah,
but doubles is brilliant in terms of socializing and everyone getting their share of game time as well.
Yeah.
Ravi, we're going to go
ambidextrous.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Healthy Habits.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
This is Dubai Eye 103.8. We have Ravi on the line, the founder of Duplays here in the UAE. And continuing our talk earlier on this hour of psychology and the importance of staying active and being outdoors and socialising through the power of sport and being active. Ravi is talking to us about the likes of Duplays, which, of course, he founded many years ago. During the commercial break there, Ravi, we were just talking a bit more about paddle tennis as well. And you don't recommend playing it as singles, do you? Because as I mentioned, I tried it and it is awfully tiring playing paddle tennis as singles. You can't really get a proper rally going.
No, exactly. You don't also have a partner to blame to blame your shot on if you hit it into the net. So.
Exactly that. It's got to be played in doubles. So, Ravi, Duplays, it's been around a long time here in the UAE. Started off really bringing people together through the power of sporting activities. But where is Duplays now? How far have you come over the past few years? And how's it been over this last year with obviously the challenges we've been through?
Yeah, so we've been around for over 10 years and started, as you said, as sort of Dubai's de facto adult sport and social club, organizing team sports socially in evenings and weekends for adults here in Dubai. In the last couple of years, we've sort of, I don't want to say pivoted, but maybe progressed and moved away from organizing sports, given the fact that there's other great providers here that, quite frankly, and sort of self-effacingly have done a better job of organizing a specific sport, to more focusing on trying to build sort of social infrastructure here, using some of the technologies that we've seen in the US and Canada and kind of bring into this region. But I think for us personally, it's been a journey. Duplays is the sort of veteran, I guess, of Dubai, battered and bruised, you know, for better or for worse. And it's been a challenge, I would say, in the last couple of years as we've moved away from running leagues and evolving our own business, like any other entrepreneurial, I guess, venture would have to do, you know, 10 years on.
It must be quite nice for you, though, to see the growth in these sporting social clubs in the UAE, because, I mean, really, a lot of places where you go now, whether that's beachside, whether that's inner city, there are many, many more facilities in terms of courts. We talked about paddle tennis, but that must be quite pleasing for you to see, because essentially all those years ago, you sort of started that trend here.
Yeah, no, it's super rewarding. And, you know, some of our past admins and operations managers have gone off to kind of specialize and focus on sports that we initially ran with them that they've now done themselves, and they started their own businesses. I think the other cool thing about Dubai, maybe unlike North America or Europe or other parts of the world, is you have such a diversity of team sports here. In Canada, I guess my reference, you wouldn't have both basketball leagues and netball leagues, whereas here, given sort of the large Commonwealth community, you have both. You have action cricket, you have touch rugby, you have softball, you have American flag football, you have beach volleyball, obviously kind of the other sports that are popular kind of globally. But it's such an amazing place because literally you can count on both hands the number of team sports that are played to a high level here in the UAE and Dubai specifically.
And as you say as well, the temperature here is so favourable for playing sport outdoors here for most of the year. And of course, in the summer, we do have those indoor facilities as well. Ravi, I know you've got a new venture as well, Nook Work. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so Nook is the region's first licensed co-working space. Specifically to help, I guess, you know, some of the same things that Duplays struggled with back in the day. So getting a proper trade license, getting an Ajari, having the proper insurance, you know, kind of professionalizing, I guess, your sporting craft. So we opened that about 2 years ago as we sort of pivoted away from what Duplay's used to run. And the idea is that we partnered with the DMCC Free Zone and offering discounted trade licenses to kind of sectors in sports, health, fitness, wellness, lifestyle, events management to give them a more agile, affordable way of staying in business or starting a business, given the fact there's been, you know, huge churn and quite a lot of disruption of people losing their jobs during this pandemic. So we're proud. Now, we have 100-plus companies that call Nook Home in one JLT, and we really have a nice community of people that are super passionate about the sport or fitness or health initiative that they're trying to start.
Yeah, that's great. And of course, in this era as well, there's so many opportunities to create a startup, and it's often the biggest challenge, isn't it? That question of how do I actually start a startup? But there's so many companies now in Dubai which really do help you with that. So that's great, Ravi. Thank you so much for joining us today. How do we find out more about both Duplay's and Nook as well?
So for Nook, if you can go to our website, please, nookwork.ae, you'll see kind of all of the programs and services and hopefully kind of support that we can offer other entrepreneurs. And yeah, Duplay's is what Duplay's has been for the last 10 years, duplay's.com. And it's more of a holding website to talk about some of our new projects that we're working hard on launching, with or without the pandemic kind of thwarting part of the journey.
Ravi, thank you so much for being with us today, and well done, and keep up all of the good work as well. See you soon.
Thanks. Thank you.
Stay safe. That is Ravi Bussara there, the founder of Duplay's and now, of course, Nook Work as well.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
It's Tom Bushell in for Helen. Listen to us on the Dubai Eye website or wherever you get your podcast. And Helen is live every day from 2 p.m. on Dubai Eye.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.